I'm Beth Fertig, sitting in for Brian Lehrer. From hip-hop videos to comedy routines and that song we just heard, the theme is clear. Don't snitch. T-shirts with the phrase, stop snitching, are sold on the streets of New York, other cities, and over the internet. And it's not just a slogan. Rap artist Busta Rhymes has yet to tell police what he did or didn't see when a security guard was killed at his video shoot, and Lil' Kim did jail time for lying on the witness stand to protect someone. And there are reports of less famous witnesses being intimidated in the courtroom or even killed in their homes. Is it a case of drug dealers and gangbangers running amok, rap artists and wannabes wanting to look tough? Or is this a show of community solidarity in the face of a distrusted and abusive criminal justice system? We'll talk about this latest twist in community relations with two guests who have considered the issue.
I was a police officer in Baltimore for 2 years. Where and when the stop snitching concept hit the streets. And I'm currently a professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice here in New York.
And so what do you have to say to this argument?
Well, I agree with Alexandra that the war on drugs is the root cause of all this, and until the war on drugs gets reexamined, the culture will exist. But what I don't think she places proper attention to is it's not just flipping low-level drug dealers. The stop snitching concept also goes to just plain old witnesses to crime. And as long as, in a way, they're sympathizers for stop snitching, these crimes don't get solved because you cannot solve a crime without a willing witness who will testify in court. And the fear, and it's a real fear, and witness intimidation and perjury on the stand are sort of separate issues that have to be addressed.
What do you say to that, Alexandra?
Thank you, Peter, for pointing that out. I agree with you absolutely. We need to distinguish between criminal snitches, that is, criminals who are getting a benefit from giving information, and regular law-abiding citizens who want to provide information to the police. I think one of the very disturbing and dangerous results of this, what I call the snitching institution or the informant institution, is that because criminal snitching is so pervasive as a result, I agree with Peter, as a result of the war on drugs, that it's tainted many people's perceptions of cooperating with the police at all. We have a big problem here in Los Angeles. The police complain that many individuals in some of our poorest and most high-crime communities won't cooperate with them. And the flip side of that is that the individuals in the community say, well, we don't trust the police to protect us or to act on our behalf with respect to crime. So it's a two-way street. And I think that the snitching institution, the public policy of flipping criminal defendants, has been a major contributor to this blurring of the line.
Peter, can you give us any examples that you saw while you were in Baltimore, maybe?
Well,
don't name names.
Well, someone's got to snitch. The biggest example was the name's forgetting me. The house was the Dawson home that was firebombed and burnt down and killed the entire family of five people. That was a friend of mine was the primary officer at the scene of that house. There are many cases of witnesses getting beat up and even killed who sometimes we're convinced to testify. I mean, a routine thing for a police handling a shooting, especially in the ghetto, is you go around and you knock on doors. It's called canvassing, and you say, did you see anything? And the answer is always no, even no matter what the truth is. And as a police officer, you know that means the person will, in fact, get away with murder, but you're also sympathetic because if I live there, the criminals are there all the time, and the cops are only there every now and then. So there is a matter of personal safety, but it's that culture does go beyond the drug trade. I mean, I teach from the stop snitching video in my classes at John Jay.
Oh, you really do?
I ask my students how many of them would be willing to testify, and a lot of it depends on where they're from. But what I find is interesting is many of my students assume that they have a right not to testify, that the Fifth Amendment applies to testifying in court, which it doesn't.
Hmm.
And it is beyond being a practical necessity, there is sort of a civic duty to testify, and then, we have better words for it, but people have to snitch. That's how criminals get caught.
We also have a caller from Brooklyn. Thank you so much, Peter. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Essentially, I stated before that I'm a teacher in Brooklyn, and even the culture of what you call snitching is ingrained in our middle school students, where if there is a fight or there is a attempt jumping where a group of students try to beat up one another, there's an unwillingness for those who observe what happened to come forward and tell the administrators what happened. And all you hear is, well, snitches get stitches, you do not snitch, and they're wearing the paraphernalia, the t-shirts, the pants, whatever may have you. And at some point, we, as your previous caller said, we need to change the conversation, stop calling it snitching, and call it for what it is, a civil obligation that we all have to preserve the laws of our country to encourage people to do the right thing. You know, if you observe something that's a crime, something that shouldn't have happened, you have a moral obligation to state what happened to the correct officials. Now, when we call it snitching, and we do not allow, we do not teach that moral content, that moral obligation, then we
okay.
have a problem.
Thank you, Mark, so much for your call. We're going to have to take a break. It's Beth Fertig filling in for Brian Lehrer, and we're talking about snitching with our guest, Alexandra Natapoff. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Beth Fertig in for Brian Lehrer, and we're talking about the phenomenon of snitching, or in this case, stop snitching, with Alexandra Natapoff, a professor at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles, who's written about the topic, snitching and the institutional communal consequences. And she's here to tell us why all these T-shirts that say stop snitching are appearing even in courtrooms. We're also joined by Peter Moskos, who's a former Baltimore police officer and a professor at John Jay College. Alexandra, I want to get back to something that's sort of underneath the surface here, and maybe not so underneath the surface, but the way that we're talking about this, you know, we're mentioning cases involving hip-hop artists, and is this something that's confined to the Black community? Because it's much more prevalent than that, I imagine, and I don't want our listeners to think that we're just talking about something that's going on in the Black community.
Absolutely.
Or communities.
Yes, I'm glad you raised that, Beth. Of course, it's not confined to the Black community, and again, when snitching becomes a dangerous public policy, it has to do with factors that go beyond the mere use of snitches. But we do know that the war on drugs has disproportionately affected the African-American community, in particular young Black males, so we can't dissociate the particular reaction of young people in communities that have been hard hit by the war on drugs and their reaction to the idea of snitching. If I can, I'd love to go back to the example that Peter brought up, the Dawson case.
Sure.
In Baltimore, because it's such an important case.
Just state the facts of that.
Pardon?
Just restate the facts of that case, please.
Absolutely. That was a terrible, terrible case where a family, Angela Dawson and her children, were killed. Their house was firebombed because they had tried to call the police about drug dealers in the community. And they were witnesses. They were not themselves involved in the drug trade. They're sort of a classic example, if you will, of the worst aspects of the stop snitching culture. On the other hand, the Dawson family, and this is apparent from court papers and the civil suit that was filed afterwards, the Dawson family called the police many, many, many times. The family complained that they were not helped, that they weren't protected when they were threatened. The individual who threatened them was briefly detained and released the next day. The question of trust in the community, especially in high crime communities, is a two-way street. We want people to go to the police and share their information, but we also need people to be able to trust that the police will take care of them, respect them, and back them up. And that was lacking in the Dawson case in a very in a terrible and disturbing way.
I want to add that we're being joined by Peter Moskos, who's a professor at John Jay College and also a former Baltimore police officer. We're very glad that Peter is able to join us because our original guest, Mark Claxton, who's a retired city police detective and co-founder of 100 Blacks in Law Enforcement Who Care, was unable to get into the building because he carries a firearm and we have some very tight security in this building. In this case, apparently a little heavy-handed, perhaps, because they wouldn't even let a retired police officer in. So anyway, Peter, going back to your experiences in Baltimore, did you agree with Alexandra that this is a consequence of the war on drugs and that it's affecting particularly the African-American community and making them less responsive to police officers because they don't trust them, and for good reason?
It's absolutely related to the war on drugs. I mean, it's both an effect and a cause of it. I should mention that the culture of stop snitching, though it's most prominent now in poor ghettos, its roots are based on a idealization of Italian mob culture.
It sounds very mafioso, right? You know,
and,
the omerta?
Exactly. So, and people who wear stop snitching T-shirts are often aware of that, and, you know, they model themselves after John Gotti or whomever. So it's a cross-cultural, transracial trend, but it's certainly affecting the black community far more than the white community.
We've been taking some calls, and I want to get to them in a moment, but it certainly has affected the popular culture. We have a little segment here by the comedian Dave Chappelle, who did a little send-up of it as well.
I said there are so many amendments in the Constitution of the United States of America. I can only choose one. I can only choose one. I plead the fifth. I plead the fifth. Five. One, two, three, four, fifth.
That was Dave Chappelle pleading the fifth on the stand in one of his routines. But as our guests have mentioned, you can't plead the fifth in a case like that?
I mean, no, the fifth is about self-incrimination, among other things. But if you witness a felony and you know, you can be taken in handcuffs before the court to testify, part of the problem, though, is courts are very, and politicians are unwilling to force honest testimony from people because it's often seen as blaming the victims or being unfair to a largely powerless group. But there's a lot of, based on stop snitching, there's a lot of perjury going out there, and it's rarely prosecuted, and people know that. So
I imagine a lot of, they must be pointing the fingers at the wrong people quite often, too. And how what happens when that occurs? What do you do?
Well, that's a greater problem with our justice system. There's false testimony. I mean, anyone who is involved with a criminal justice system, and I know it from the police side, I mean, knows that it's largely a joke. But what isn't a joke is that murderers walk free, and you do literally get away with murder. And if I could go back to one good point that Alexandra made about the flipping concept, there is an emphasis on flipping. And when I was in Baltimore, former New York police officer Ed Norris, and now convicted felon Ed Norris, was the commissioner, and he implemented that where everybody arrested for a drug offense was brought to the police district and questioned by detectives. And it's based under the assumption that there's some kingpin out there, and if we could just work our way up the ladder. But just as the low-level drug dealer, and that's who I dealt with, just as the low-level drug dealer can be replaced within minutes, the mid-level drug dealer can be replaced just as easily, so that the effort spent on sort of climbing up the drug chain is largely useless because this, the same law of supply and demand affects all levels of the drug trade. So I question what the benefit even of getting people to flip and testify in higher-ups is. Hmm.
Well, I'd like to take calls. My name is Beth Fertig. I'm sitting in for Brian Lehr, and the phone number here is 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. We're taking calls on the topic of snitching, and we have Jim on the line from the South Bronx. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Sure.
Yeah, I've been in the South Bronx for 10 years. I agree that the war on drugs needs to be rethought, but I think thanks largely to the war on drugs, the quality of life in this neighborhood is infinitely better. People told me I was insane to move into this neighborhood 10 years ago because of the drugs and the crime associated with it, because of the crackdown on it and the fact that it threw so many lower-level drug dealers in prison. This place is much, much more livable. There are new businesses here. There are people moving in here. And, yeah, the war on drugs has to be rethought. But in the meantime, these lower-level dealers need to be in prison. And as far as the hip-hoppers go, who cares about them? They've always been enablers of lower-class, you know, ghetto culture. I'm black, by the way, if you want to know. And who cares what their opinions are? They may express a certain view, but I don't find it valid at all.
Jim, you've raised a really interesting issue, which is, you know, certainly in the past 10, 15 years in New York, we've seen the broken windows theory and police applying it to low-level crimes in the hopes of getting the big fish.
And it worked.
We have seen evidence of that here in New York, haven't we? I mean, Alexandra, Peter, what do you say to that? Isn't there some proof that it can work?
Well, what worked was pushing drug dealers inside. The problem isn't drugs, and the problem isn't so much even people using drugs. The problem is public drug dealing, and that's a result of the war on drugs.
I entirely agree. I absolutely agree. But until the laws are changed, these people causing this havoc have to be imprisoned.
Well, imprisoning them isn't going to work. I mean, we've done that. We have 2 million people in prison in this country.
I've lived here for 10 years. Don't tell me that hasn't worked. I live here.
What worked is getting drug dealers off the street, but there's an alternative to prison, which is people should be buying drugs from their friends and coworkers. That's how you have the suburban marijuana trade that's largely nonviolent. There's still drugs in your neighborhood. The point is they're not selling them on the street, and that's the key.
Well, what happened to the ones who were on the streets around Jim's neighborhood?
A lot in New York specifically, an effort has, but two things happened. Is an effort was made to push them inside, which is the main part, and a lot of drugs were taken off the streets. Things were de-escalized, violence was brought down due to police action, and that's the broken windows and the tipping point concept that came into play.
A lot of them aged out, by the way. I see them coming back here after doing a number of years in prison. Instead of 19 or 20, they're now 28 or 30, and they tend to be less harmful at that age.
Well, people age out of the crime, certainly. But, I mean, everyone we put in prison is going to come out, and that's a whole other problem.
Beth, if I could respond to something else that Jim said.
Sure.
Not so much on the crime policy, but he suggested that maybe we shouldn't, I think he said, who cares about them, right? Maybe we shouldn't care what folks in the hip-hop community or maybe the young people who are at risk for drug use and drug dealing think, and that our response to them should be to lock them up. And I'd like to very respectfully suggest that maybe that's not the best approach to handling large parts of our community, of our population, who are at risk. And the war on drugs, the terrible thing about the war on drugs is that it has curtailed the life possibilities of so many young people in communities like the South Bronx where Jim lives. And to say in a democracy that we don't care about the opinions of the young people, of the residents, of the citizens of our country, I think suggests something about our democracy has failed. And I would suggest that even when we don't like the message of hip-hop, when it suggests that some parts of our public policy are not working, are not responding the way we want them to, that we should care very much about it, and that we should take a hard look at the policies that may have generated those attitudes.
Hip-hop reflects life.
Yeah, Jim, what were you just saying?
Specifically is that I don't care about the opinions of hip-hoppers. By the way, I'm an educator, so I care very much what young people think. My attitude is that I oppose the values and the attitudes of the hip-hoppers, and as an educator, I try to give my students an alternative vision of life, so that there's more to life than the latest rap album with the latest wannabe thug has to say.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Jim, for your call.
Bye-bye.
Take care. We also have another Jim from Westchester on the line with us. Hi, what's your response to this?
Hello?
Hi, you're here. You're on the air.
Yes, hi.
Could you identify yourself, please?
My name is actually Ahmed from Westchester.
Oh, I'm sorry. We got it wrong.
No problem. The last color concert, The Wind Out of My Sails, is what I wanted to talk about.
Oh, so you're just going to say the same thing?
Well, not exactly the same thing. But I was going to say that my comment was, and by the way, great program.
Thank you.
My comment was about the hip-hop culture itself and its emulation, you know, of the gangster lifestyle, i.e. the Tony Sopranos and the John Gottis or what have you, of conducting yourself in a criminal manner and thinking that if no one, you know, i.e. flips or snitches or rats on someone, that it's going to work. And I think the mentality just needs to change among young people. I'm a young person, and I am part of the hip-hop generation, that, you know, crime is not the way to be successful. And there has to be a change of mentalities, and there's another emphasis on things that are positive within the community rather than trying to conduct a criminal, you know, organization where no one says anything about anybody else. They're doing things that are bad for the community.
Isn't it also true, though, that young people have always tried to look tough and look bad, you know, from all walks of life, all cultures, you know, whether it was James Dean and, you know, his leather jacket, which looks pretty quaint right now. But, you know, everybody wants to look tough. And how much of this is just posturing?
Yeah, I definitely agree, because I went to college, and not to get too specific, but, you know, I was in the fraternity system, and within that system, and there were a lot of people who sold drugs, and I'm talking about white kids from the suburbs, mm-hmm. not your brother on the street, and everyone would act all tough and listen to rap. So, yeah, no snitching. But I remember a few drug busts that happened within that community, and people were singing a different tune when they were faced with time.
So they were snitching.
Exactly.
Okay. Thanks very much for your call. Alexandra and Peter, do you think, you know, do you think a lot of it with the T-shirts and stuff is a fad that's going to go away? Or do you think that this is something that's really deeply ingrained right now, that it's going to take a lot of effort by the police to turn this attitude around in communities?
If I could answer that, Beth, I'm glad you asked the question in that way, because I think there is a tendency when the T-shirts come out, or when a high-profile hip-hop artist does something, to focus on that instance. To say, well, the problem is the T-shirts, right? Or the problem is hip-hop.
Or the problem is heavy metal.
Or the problem is whatever the problem of the moment is. And that's why it's so important to look behind the problem. I think that sometimes the T-shirts are a terrible problem when they're used as witness intimidation. And sometimes they're just a fad that kids wear, as you say, to look cool, right? The new James Dean. So the answer can't be in the T-shirts, and it can't be in looking at hip-hop. We have to ask, what is the society are we doing about crime? And Ahmed said, you know, crime is not the way. We need to instill that principle in our young people. Well, turning criminals into snitches and letting them off does not send the message that crime is not the way. It sends the message that maybe you can get away with it if you're useful enough.
Do you think that there's going to be any change in the mentality from... There's some high-profile cases. I mean, certainly this one involving Busta Rhymes and, you know, his security guard who got gunned down. And there's a lot of pressure on him, and columnists saying, you know, to boycott his music even, because he and his people should come forward and say what they saw. Daily News columnist Errol Lewis has written on this, and he's seen a connection between the anti-snitching mentality and silence that let Nix Mary Brown's death happen, the little girl who was allegedly murdered by her mother and stepfather here in New York. People don't say anything. They don't tell what's going on because they don't want to get themselves in trouble. Do you see a link between this?
I'm not sure that putting pressure on any one individual... We can put Busta Rhymes in prison for not testifying. Peter's absolutely right. I'm not sure that changes the underlying problem of the lack of trust and communication between police and the community.
But I guess, do you think that cases, these high-profile cases, do you think may change the mentality if they see that it's innocent people just like them who are being hurt by refusing to testify?
I think the high-profile cases also could serve the point. I think the culture could change, even if through causes don't. At least it would tell people, it would educate people that you don't have a right not to testify. But the whole, the T-shirts and the stop snitching, I don't think that's changed the culture at all. The T-shirts haven't. That just has educated the outside world and public radio listeners about what has long existed. You know, Carmelo Anthony, who was the basketball player in the video, it was nothing new to him. He just happened to be sort of in the wrong place at the wrong time. And it is a lot of posturing, but if I could say two quick stats about the neighborhoods I policed, I mean, the posturing reflects a dangerous reality. 10% of the men in East Baltimore get murdered in their lifetime, more than 10%. And there are 27,000 arrests in a community with 45,000 people. That goes beyond posturing. I mean, the isolation and the severity of violent crime in the drug trade is all too real, but it's largely unknown outside of these communities.
I think that's right. I think Peter made such an important point, which is that it's not enough to get upset on public radio about T-shirts or about a hip-hop artist. If we're really concerned about it, then we need to look at what's really happening in the communities where the stop snitching culture is about life preservation, about the relationship of the community to law enforcement. And we need to have more information, like the information that Peter is sharing with us, so that we can actually address those issues.
Okay. Any other solutions that you see going forward?
Well, I'd like to see more public attention paid to the institution of snitching. Obviously, we don't want names revealed or identities put out in the public. That's dangerous. But we could certainly have a much more accountable and transparent snitching process so we could figure out, as Peter pointed out, does snitching really reduce crime in these high-drug, high-crime neighborhoods, or are we just perpetuating it? Well, police and prosecutors could give us that data. Again, not about individual snitches, but how many crimes are solved based on snitch information? If we knew that, then we could make an intelligent argument about whether it's a good idea or not.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I'm going to have to give you the last word because we're out of time. I'm Beth Fertig, sitting in for Brian Lehr. You're listening to WNYC Radio 93.9 and AM 820. We've been speaking with Alexandra Natapoff, an associate professor at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles and author of a law review article on snitching. We've also been joined at the last minute, thankfully, by Peter Moskos, a former Baltimore police